Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
With Mitchell Davis, but I am not Mitchell Davis. I am Karen Karp, the president and founder of Karp Resources, a food and agriculture consulting business here in New York City. And I am Mitchell's guest host today. And my guest is Noel Labatt-Comes, who is the founder of Tomcat Bakery and the founder of a new business called Just Enough of a Very Good Thing. And Noel, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Karen. I'm really happy to be here.
My pleasure. Let's dive right in, because we've been preparing for this show for a week and we have a lot we want to talk about. I would like you first, to take our listeners back in time. Tell people what they would have seen in New York City in the 1980s, what was the food landscape like here 30 years ago?
Well, you know, it's funny. I came to New York to start working at a restaurant called The Quilted Giraffe. And oddly enough, it was right around the corner from Lutece. And I can't think of a better sort of scenario to exemplify the situation right then. Mm-hmm. The Quilted Giraffe, I would say, was sort of it was a very disruptive force in high-end cuisine in New York. And Lutece was ultra-traditional. Just before I arrived in New York in 1981. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to think of how to best describe this. And I think that sort of the talking heads had not sort of occurred in New York cuisine. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Lutece was a very high-quality restaurant, doing things really beautifully. But they were doing the standards over and over and over again. And I think there was a tremendous amount of that in New York City. And then the Quilted Giraffe and a couple of other places came along, and they were really disruptive forces. Mm-hmm. And they brought Nouvelle Cuisine, which mm-hmm. came from France, which in itself was a disruptive force, but it was disrupting a very different world over there.
Right.
And they also, part of that was an appreciation for the quality of raw ingredients. Mm-hmm. And I think that appreciation and the cuisine around it did a lot to explode the culinary world as mm-hmm. it was known at the time and mm-hmm. as it's become over mm-hmm. the last, how many years?
It's about
30 years.
Yeah, it's about 30 years. Yeah, so. It's okay. On this show, I think it's okay for us to date ourselves, because there are so many shows on this network that are really about what's going on today, right now, and, you know, a lot of futuristic thinking about food. And I like, when I'm doing this show, I like to give people the sort of longer view perspective back, so that we can understand perhaps a different way of thinking about the future.
So, well, they need to know where it came from.
Yeah, right.
So exactly. We're here to help.
Yeah. So I mean, I came to New York in 1978 and I graduated college in 1982. So I always worked in food, but in a much different genre, like in, you know, Greenwich Village cafes, working as a waitress and sort of, you know, Israeli cafes and Persian nightclubs. And, you know, I was very kind of connected to the political stuff that was going on in New York at the time, and not so much the culinary. That kind of came a little bit later. But you were there really at sort of what ground zero is, what was happening culinarily in New York City. Describe kind of like the evolution from your days working at the Quilted Giraffe and what you were seeing in that disruption to how you got the idea for becoming an artisan bread baker.
Well, I think that starting in the 80s, there was a tremendous inrush of culinary influence and it really was a turning point. I think that between what was going on in France and it came from California. You know, there was Michael's out in Los Angeles, which I think was really it was a seminal American restaurant, and some of the people actually who would work there came to work at the Quilted Giraffe. Jonathan Waxman showed up, and they opened jams, and I can still remember the frisson, how excited American New Yorkers were that this place was coming, and it was a really big deal, and I think that there on in both at the complex level that the Quilted Giraffe was offering, and also at a simpler level where places like Jams and Patrick's at the Odeon were offering. The perception of food as something that was foreign and sort of a treat into something that was really intrinsic to us started to happen.
That in and of itself was very different, right? We were always importing cuisines from other places.
Exactly. And so now we had our own sort of native form, and there were a lot of people who were really deeply into it. And professionally speaking, it also became a much more exciting, interesting, and profession where there's a lot more opportunity for people who were thinking about food to actually do something with it, make a living, and enjoy themselves.
Right. It's true. I mean, I remember that kind of turning point in the 80s when working in a restaurant or working with food shifted from being something that you had to do to pay your bills to something that became a career, artistry, something.
It became a craft form and an art form that a lot of creative people really enjoyed working within, despite, working in a kitchen is difficult, working in a restaurant. But nonetheless, there's a tremendous amount of creativity and artistic expression that goes on. And for people who like to work with their hands and create things, it's nonstop. Mm-hmm. So that was really great. And interestingly enough, I found that when I went into the Artisan Bread Bakery, that all of the people who were really driving the growth of the artisan bread world were people who came from the fine cuisine world. Uh-huh. It wasn't that traditional bakers were seeing the light and transforming themselves, but it was people who had come from good restaurants and who traveled around the world and seen bread and other baked products being made better than they were in the U.S. and trying to improve what was going on here.
Right.
And I became one of them.
You were one of them. I mean, I've actually always had this sort of fantasy about how you got the idea for Tomcat, and I'm just going to try it out on air now. You can tell me that you're working at the Quilted Giraffe, and all this great food is happening, and all this wonderful creative disruption, all these wonderful creative people, etc. And you walk around the dining room, and you're like, "Well, that thing on that little plate isn't very good. So I think we can do that better."
Well, that process had already happened, and we made our own bread because there was nothing that we wanted to buy in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And so as I became more and more involved with that, and I was in France on an eating trip, which was one of my privileges, and professional privileges, and I was in the Fnac, and I found an apprentice baker's workbook in the food section.
Incredible.
And it basically explained how to make high quality traditional bread in a contemporary setting, and that became my Bible, and I still have it. And it's completely marked up and dog eared, but that is sort of finding that book, and also having seen Acme Bakery in Berkeley, California, really were the things that convinced me that it was possible to do it, because the myth had been in the U.S. that you couldn't make good bread in the U.S. because the flour wasn't right, which there was some truth to, but a lot of it was that the know-how wasn't here, and the equipment wasn't here, and that know-how and that equipment was available in Europe, and a number of us acquired the know-how and acquired the equipment and got baking
and just went for it. Yeah. So, what else gave you confidence? Who were your supporters? How did you take the idea and make it a viable business concept? At the early stage. I mean, how did you go around and say, if I bake it, will you come? I mean, was it something like that?
Well, I had an interesting conversation with Miles Kahn, who's the man who founded Coach Farm, among other things. And he said to me, he was a prospective investor who initially turned me down. Mm-hmm. But he said, if I had known what was involved with the business when I started it, I wouldn't have started it.
And his business.
Yeah. But that's a line of mine. I mean, yeah. if you knew, you wouldn't do it.
Right.
But fortunately, I didn't. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of assumptions that you work against. Mm-hmm. Some of them are right, and mm-hmm. some you change. Mm-hmm. And in terms of, I mean, some financial supporters, and also, Danny Meyer was mm-hmm. one of my initial investors, and also Mark Sarazen.
Uh-huh.
But why they invested in me? I don't know exactly in terms on a personal basis, and maybe I need to do some more exploration to figure that out. these many years down the road, but I will tell you that one of the things I'm good at is recognizing a white space in the market mm-hmm. and saying, here's something either that is not being done or being badly done and can be done better. I think of myself fundamentally as an improver.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was very clear. And it happened to be something that I really like to do, which is pretty much the only thing that I can do.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been making bread since I was, a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
So here was an opportunity to do something that I loved. There was a definite need for it. I was considering becoming a restaurant chef and having my own restaurant, but the bakery cost me 1/5 of what it would have cost to start a restaurant. There was a need in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a need for another $1 million restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
So it seemed like a better bet.
Right.
And I love doing it too.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk about the next white space that you've defined and that you're pursuing a little bit later in the show. But you mentioned Danny Meyer, and I knew that about Danny, and it's really kind of interesting. He kind of started bringing that kind of new style of defined American cuisine based on something else downtown. And like that was sort of mm-hmm. one of the early waves of creating a restaurant and a dining scene downtown. I'm just going to tell you a tiny little story about how Danny Meyer invested in my business. He was about to hire me to be a restaurant manager at Union Square Cafe. I was making a decision between two jobs, working for Danny and becoming a consultant working for someone else. And Danny Meyer was interviewing me, and this last interview, third interview, and he's like, I will offer you a job, but you shouldn't take it.
And how old was he at the time?
I don't know. He was like a year older or younger than I am now. He was a babe in arms and very, prescient, as the word to use your word earlier. And he said, you need to be in business for yourself. So that's what you should do. So I'll offer you a job, but I don't want you to take it. And I will never forget that. Mm-hmm. And, so lots of kind of creative thinking about how food was going to, explode and really become something I'm remembering now. This is what we get for being our age, is to kind of remember the baseline of what's happening now was, I think, really started then in the 80s. So for just a moment, because we're going to have a break in a minute or so, can you describe, you became a food manufacturer. I mean, I know you were making artisan bread and you were selling it to high-end restaurants, but essentially you were in the business of food manufacturing. How did you see yourself in the New York City manufacturing landscape, if you did, at the time?
As a food, I don't think I saw myself so much as a food manufacturer, because I was very much involved in the artisan bread community. Mm-hmm. I think when I looked at myself as an employer, where we employed a lot of people and we spent a lot of our time worrying about the things that an employer worries about and trying to be a good employer, which I think that's where I saw myself more as a manufacturer. And also interactions with the city had to do in terms of promoting job growth and what type of funding might be available for a manufacturing business that created jobs for low and middle income workers. There I saw myself as a manufacturer. Uh-huh. But in the bread business per se, I don't think I saw myself so much as a manufacturer.
Did you find New York City a supportive environment for that? I mean, there was a recession that happened in the early 90s, which is just a couple years after, probably when you moved to the space that became the big Tomcat.
Was it Black Friday? Was it Black Friday or Black Monday? I can't remember.
Black Monday, I think.
Black Monday, you know, when the market collapsed. Yeah. That was like 4 weeks into the after we opened our doors.
Right.
You know?
That was the 88, right? And then there was another one that happened in the 92
or so.
Yeah,
that was a very intense one. So things started off in the world around us badly. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, we were just starting off and there was demand for our product, but certainly the marketplace was having trouble.
Right. There's some similarities now where... for lots of reasons, large-scale food manufacturing necessarily has moved out of New York City because of cost and logistics and infrastructure. But specialty food manufacturing is one of the only glimmers of light on the manufacturing landscape in New York City right now. And it's interesting to me that it comes in the midst of another recession where job creation is, until our hurricane hit, job creation is the number one thing on every policymaker's mind.
Well, there are a lot of people out there trying to figure out how to, you know, to use the mental and creative powers that they have and they're no longer employed. So they look for options that are outside of their comfort zone.
Yes, absolutely. So we're going to take a short break now, and we're going to come back and talk a little bit about New York City today and tomorrow in the future and your next venture.
Oh, great.
You're listening to This One by Snowmine on heritageradionetwork.org. From my happiest to the depths of my soul, I let loose a storm and watch it fall down. No matter where it lies, but only where I am.
Pastures is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. A full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I am Karen Karp, filling in for Mitchell Davis today, and our guest is Noel Abak-Comes, the founder of Tomcat Bakery and founder of a new venture called Just Enough of a Very Good Thing, which is about to launch, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. I just want to kind of create a transition a little bit from the Tomcat era to the Just Enough of a Very Good Thing era a little bit. If you could sort of place yourself, Noel, in the New York City timeline from 1988 when you started Tomcat to a few years ago when you sold Tomcat and where you're going next. Can you tell us about some of the internal and external factors that influence your decision to move on? Exactly. I was going to say to let Tomcat go, but that's not right. It's better.
Too many years of being sour, I guess. the Tomcat was 20, 21 years old, and I still love bread, but it was a business that grew wonderfully, and we basically reached the point where we couldn't grow it the way we wanted to anymore, and a lot of us had been there for a long time always enjoyed that very much. And we felt stuck, and we liked the product that we were making, but we just the business environment made it not that enjoyable, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. so that was one reason. And I felt like I wanted to do something new. Mm-hmm. And oddly enough, when I sold the business, there was, you know, I ended up with a non-compete, which mm-hmm. is normal. And there were a couple of carve-outs, and one of them was to make desserts to be sold in supermarkets. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have a concrete vision of what it was going to do, but there was a possibility that something was percolating already.
Right, right. I mean, you put that in there, or that just happened to be where
for it. Yeah. I asked for it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, great. So. Well, that's a perfect entree. Yeah. A perfect segue.
It's not an entree. It's a dessert.
That's right. It's a dessert. So tell us a little bit about your next venture.
The story is that, an idea was percolating there. I was never formally trained as a pastry chef, mm-hmm. although at the Quilted Giraffe, we were known for our desserts, and we did them all in house, and I very much enjoyed that. And my wife, who is French, also a driving force here, said to me, "You know, in France, there's all these really wonderful little sort of spoon or single serving desserts that I can get. There's this enormous choice. In the U.S. there's very little, and what there is not so great." Mm-hmm. And so, you know, then my little white space light went off. And also, as I said earlier, I can't do something that I don't really want to do. And so between the legal opening mm-hmm. of having thought about this, right. the fact that I do love to make desserts, here was something new for me to learn mm-hmm. At a higher level. And learning about selling into supermarkets, though some people may think that this is not a particularly desirable idea, was something new for me to learn. Mm-hmm. And I need to be learning something new. Mm-hmm. So I think those things, plus, you know, sort of keeping your wife happy is a pretty important.
Because she's going to be able to have her just desserts.
Yes, exactly. And my kids love it too. Yeah. So, you know, what better motivation than
right.
to...
I am now remembering that you and I had a conversation relatively early on in your thinking about this, about the supermarket business, about how to get in. And we talked significantly about quality ingredients, which of course... I and many other people know are really important to you. But I haven't heard about that since. So how did you go? Well, first describe what the product is if you want to do that. I mean,
they're little sort of single serving fancy desserts that are sold in a glass ramekin. Uh-huh. They're multi-layered. They're like a parfait. Uh-huh. But there's a custard layer, a curd layer, a crumb layer. Imagine something like a cheesecake, but mm-hmm. not a cheesecake.
Right.
And you eat it for dessert or at a 4 o'clock treat.
Uh-huh.
And it's made with really high quality ingredients, and it's it's beautifully balanced, and it's pretty to look at.
Right.
And you generally want a second one, even though you shouldn't.
Right. So, great. And it's refrigerated, right?
And it's refrigerated. Right. So it's not frozen, so you don't have to defrost it for 24 hours. Mm-hmm. It's an impulse.
And you don't have to, it's not like ready to bake. It's just ready to eat.
You
right?
just take it out and yeah. eat it.
Sounds great. So tell us about, I mean, you mentioned earlier in the first segment of the show about, you know, the myth that you couldn't make good bread in America because there wasn't good flour. And I know that that you and James and a lot of people at Tomcat went to great lengths to try to source the best flour you possibly could. But that's the past. This is the present and the future. Tell us how you went about sourcing ingredients that would be so good that if you put just a tiny bit of them in a little cup, they're going to do what I know you are going to, what I know you believe people are going to respond to when they eat them.
It's a work in progress. You know, I mean, the thing that I'm trying to solve right now is coffee, because uh-huh. there's been, we're making a tiramisu uh-huh. and, you know, I have a good espresso machine at home, and I just for the test product, I make 50 cups in a row, and I have this great espresso product. There's a lot of, industrial flavor products that are, I mean, they're not artificial. They're made from coffee, but somehow they don't effectively retain the flavor of what we consider to be good coffee mm-hmm. these days. And so I'm fishing around trying to find better product. I called, is it George? I think George Howell, is it? He's a high-end coffee roaster up in in the Boston area, and I'm waiting to hear back from them and see what they can do for me.
So is it the sourcing of the beans, or the roasting of the beans, or the making of the coffee? Is it an extract? I mean, people typically use extracts,
mm-hmm. and I've tasted, I think, 30 different extracts, and none of them really give me a flavor of a fresh cup of espresso.
Mm-hmm.
Is it because it's not possible? I don't know, but I mean, early on in the bread business, we ran into similar problems. People were so used to doing things a certain way, and they were used to this being the sort of their array of source materials, and people weren't pushing outside of that particular envelope to find new things. That eventually changed.
Right.
And so this coffee search at the moment is sort of emblematic of that same type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
We want to do something new that's better than what exists already. How are we going to do it? Do we have to do it ourselves? Do we have to find someone new to take a new approach to it?
Or help them develop a product or a type of derivative of coffee that's going to work in your recipe.
Exactly.
Right. Yep.
And we went through that both with flours in the bakery and particularly with equipment.
Uh-huh.
Great.
Tell us about the fruit. Where's the fruit coming from? How are you managing the fruit part of the desserts?
The fruit is... I tasted a bunch of fresh. Basically, we're using fresh juices for the citrus, and the fruit for the passion fruit and mango. We're using purees that come from France that are quite good.
Great, so. That's great. I know you will be launching this, launching the manufacturing part of this business upstate in Kingston. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about how you found the manufacturer, who they are, how you made that decision.
Well, the first decision was that I didn't want to be I didn't want to do my own manufacturing anymore.
Done that,
and you know, I mean, we had a nice factory, and we had a lot of employees, and we were great job creators, and I very much enjoyed that. But I don't want to do that again.
Mm-hmm.
Since one of the things that I discovered when I was trying to make a new product, something that wasn't being made in the U.S. in making the bread, is that if it's not being made, then no one's making it. Which is, I mean, sounds
it's very simple.
But there's a truth to it. And so this quality of product isn't being made in the U.S. right now. And so finding someone to do it, is they're just not there. So I was looking for someone who had an existing high-end food production facility, but who also had enough flexibility to allow me to come in and do something that was, you know, off the that was different. And so this group happens to offer me that. So that's pretty much how I chose them. And
that's
I looked
great.
At a number of different people, but they offered a lot of flexibility. And they also have a quality food orientation.
Yes, they do.
Which I think is critical.
Absolutely. I'm sure New York City is going to be sorry not to have another one of your artisan businesses located here. But, of course, you know, there are growing opportunities around the state and around the country for wonderful businesses like this seems to be. I was thinking about something you said earlier about sort of creative disruption and also about talking heads. And this morning on the way here, it's Wednesday morning, I bought the New York Times because it's the food section day. And it was the first time I bought the New York Times on a Wednesday in months. It used to be, you know, for 15 or 20 years, every single Wednesday I bought the New York Times. And I was thinking it's not because I read it online that I'm not buying it. I'm sort of not reading the New York Times that much on Wednesdays. I regret it, but I'm not doing it so much. But in the 80s, like through the history of our sort of coming of age in food, and the New York Times was really kind of the standard bearer, right? It kind of followed and led at the same time. I don't know, do you have the same experience? I mean, I'm not trying to take down the New York Times in any way, shape, or form. I loved every article I read in there today, particularly the one about Coney Island and the restaurants there. It really, really meant a lot to me, considering that we're trying to figure out how to rebuild New York and the food businesses that have been so impacted by this storm. But I more want to ask you, like, where do you think thought leadership from the media is coming for food these days? What do you read?
Well, I'm like you. I don't read the Times. I don't read the Times as much as before. But you know, like all other, like the issue with all other media, there's so many different. There's so many different things going on. Yeah. And that being said, it's I'm not a good person to ask that question because I tend to dive really deeply into what I'm doing and often leave a lot of other things to the side.
Right.
I mean, I have friends who are not in the food industry who are so much more up on it than I am. It's sort of, I'm sort of ashamed, but, there's so many blogs that are influential that right. I don't read, for example.
Yeah,
so,
sure. I mean, we can't, I mean, it's just impossible. There's just too much out there and you're also working and busy and, you know, leading your life. It's just, it's interesting to me how explosive the media, food media has become and also how diverse. I think we're almost out of time for today. I guess one final question or kind of thought I'd like you to respond to, which is today there's a sort of new food kind of movement or food revolution happening that is incredibly focused and based in this place, right? Mm-hmm. Here we are in Roberta's in Brooklyn. So much is rooted in kind of what this place stands for. What do you think is similar to what was going on in the 80s about the food movement now? And what do you think the new generation could learn from us, if anything?
Well, I think that the local thing, I think part of what's behind that is really drilling down to the essential essence of the product. Mm-hmm. You know? And I think that
The ingredients.
Yeah. And the fact that that they might be locally produced where they can be, that is a wonderful thing. I mean, one of the things that I very much enjoyed when learning about wheat was learning about the agricultural process and all the various different steps on the ladder, and you know, smaller growers versus industrial, and farm visits were just one of the greatest things you can possibly imagine, because here you are making this product in New York City. And then you're out in Kansas or in the Dakotas, and you're on a farm visit, and you're talking to the guy who's making your basic stuff, and he's so far removed from your world,
right?
And it's an incredible bond, because the worlds are so far apart, and yet you're completely intertwined with mm-hmm. them. And I think so bringing things local, I think allows people to have better access to see where the roots are, and also, you know, the economic equation, allowing someone to fund someone who is part much closer to being part of your community, I think is something that's very appealing.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's actually one of the very important and most important and to me very endearing components of this whole sort of local food revolution, is the sort of community building and the sort of localized economy that is really forming. And food is such a great thing to do that with, because it brings people together, and you can feel it and you can taste it, and then you can understand the impact that it's had locally.
And our appetites will never go away, so the drive is always there.
Correct. That's absolutely true. That's really great. Noel, is there anything else you would like to share with us before we close this episode?
No, I just wanted to thank you very much for having me here.
Oh, it's blessed.
And forcing me back into my far-flung history.
Well, it was a great pleasure. Any time you would like to be my guest on this show, when I'm guesting, just let me know, because we want to stay in touch to hear about the progress of your new business.
Thank you.
Okay. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.